You'll be familiar with the saying, a man on a mission. We would use this saying to describe someone who is focused, determined, all about his business. Well, Paul is the quintessential man on a mission. Not just any mission, but of course he is on God's mission. We've come now to the last chapter of 1 Corinthians. And we've done with the doctrinal stuff. And it's usually when we get into the greetings and the travel plans that everyone sort of shuts down. That's the boring stuff. Rush through and let's get on to the meat. Well, not so. There's often a lot of benefit that we can get from these last portions where we examine the greetings. And in particular, today, we're going to be looking at Paul's travel plan. So let's just read together from verses 5 to 12. I will visit you after passing through Macedonia, for I intend to pass through Macedonia. And perhaps I will stay with you or even spend the winter so that you may help me on my journey wherever I go. For I do not want to see you now just in passing. I hope to spend some time with you, if the Lord permits. But I will stay in Ephesus until Pentecost. For a wide door for effective work has opened to me, and there are many adversaries. When Timothy comes, see that you put him at ease among you, for he is doing the work of the Lord as I am. So let no one despise him. Help him on his way in peace, that he may return to me, for I am expecting him with the brothers. Now concerning our brother Apollos, I strongly urged him to visit you with the other brothers, but it was not at all his will to come now. He will come when he has opportunity. A person's travels and future plans can tell you a lot about their priorities. Paul was not a tourist seeking to suck the marrow out of life. He was the Lord's servant, totally given. A man who would serve the Lord anywhere, anytime, to anyone, whatever the cost. We lose sight of what it looks like to be consecrated to God. But Paul's journeys and his plans for the future are a helpful reminder that we are here for a reason, that we are not our own. So today, as we consider Paul's travel plans, as he opens this up to the Corinthian church, we'll divide this up under three headings. We'll see that Paul, a man on a mission, is dedicated to the Lord's work, submitted to the Lord's will, and committed to the Lord's workers. Read again with me verses 5 to the halfway through verse 7. I will visit you after passing through Macedonia, for I intend to pass through Macedonia. And perhaps I will stay with you or even spend the winter so that you may help me on my journey wherever I go. For I do not want to see you now just in passing. I hope to spend some time with you. Let's begin with this question. What keeps you busy? What keeps you busy? For most of us, it'll be work. If you have kids, if you're a stay-at-home mom, maybe you find yourself living the life of mom's taxi. If you have ill health, maybe it's regular visits to the doctor, the pharmacy, the hospital. What keeps Paul busy? For Paul, every decision, every step, every place visited, his whole life revolved around doing the will of the Lord. He was bent on one thing. So think for a moment with me about your plans. What's your plans for the next year? What's your 5-year plan? What's your 10-year plan? Now let's ask that question of Paul. Paul, what do you plan to do next year? What's your 5-year plan? What's your 10-year plan? For most of us, it'll be things like plans related to family, to work, to holidays. And these are good things to think about and good things to plan for. It is good for us to be responsible and plan for the future. But notice, in Paul's case, everything revolves around the Lord's work. I guess what confronts me as I consider Paul's mindset and his plans is the single-mindedness that he has. How everything in his life conforms to that overarching purpose of living for the Lord. Now, granted, he's a single man. He's not married. He's also called to be an apostle, and you are not. Neither am I. We all have different callings and vocations. But his drive, his focus, his living in light of the eternal truths at all times, the truth of sin, the truth of people's needs for salvation, the truth of God needing to be glorified, the truth of the church being central in his life. These things dictated to every single decision that he made. To see a man giving it all, whether it's his singleness, his money, his security, his health, his reputation, even his life, laying it down for the will of God, for the gospel, for the church. I don't know about you, but I find that convicting. I find that galvanizing. Now, Paul, we know, is writing from Ephesus. And we read Acts 19. I wanted you to get some of the background around why Paul was planning what his plans were. We know that Paul's stay in Ephesus was 3 years long. And he tells us in verse 9 of the portion before us that he has a wide open door for ministry. That's why he is there. So why is Paul in Ephesus? Because he's preaching. There's a wide open door of opportunity to minister for the Lord. He is lingering in Ephesus, his longest stay anywhere, 3 years, because God is profiting the work. But he also wants to travel. Why? Why does Paul want to travel? Where's Paul's goal? What did we say last week? Paul is going around collecting money for the collection of the saints. He is leading a coordinated effort because there's been a famine, because there's so many poor Christians in Judea. And he's going to all the various churches, knocking on their doors, going in and collecting the money so that he can go and help the Christian poor in Judea. So he plans to go through Macedonia. This would include the churches of Philippi, Thessalonica, Berea, churches that we're familiar with. He indicates that he will only pass through there because he wants to spend some quality time in Corinth. Perhaps as long as spending the whole winter there. Winter was, after all, a treacherous time when you didn't want to travel by sea. And there may have been some other details that Paul needed to look after. Maybe Paul was a self-supporting missionary. And so he might have had to do some work. And so wintering in Corinth, where there were lots of boats, where he could make and mend sails, this might have been part of his plan as well. But his primary plan is he wants to spend time lingering with the Corinthians. And we know why. It's a church in a very, very precarious situation. They're full of troubles. You'll notice as Paul explains his travel plans that he expects that the Corinthian church will help him on his way. So he'll come there, he'll spend some time with them, and then he expects that they will support him as he goes to the next place. That always jarred with me. He doesn't ask for support, he expects support. That's very telling. What it means is that Paul has a deep assumption that it is the obligation of churches to support the work of the ministry. To see money set aside to supporting those who are taking the word to other parts of the world. He just expects that the church will, of course, get involved in this activity. He doesn't ask, he expects. And what is he expecting? Well, it would have been things like money, supplies, even traveling companions. He expects that the local church will supply these things to enable the mission as it moves forward. But in particular, I want you to notice that Paul seeks to come to Corinth, not just to see them in passing, but to spend time with them. He wants to spend time with them because of their troubles. This is a church that's full of divisions. This is a church that is experiencing the problems of disentangling themselves from sexual immorality. This is a church where people are wandering to idols' temples and getting embroiled in idolatry. Where their own worship services are disrupted with people getting drunk at the Lord's table, with the rich not waiting for the poor, where women are suddenly throwing off traditional dress. And it's bedlam when it comes to the spiritual gifts operating in the services. And on top of that, some are even denying the bodily resurrection. So Paul wants to go to Corinth. He wants to do some pastoral triage and plug up some of those holes. He has a deep concern and burden for the churches, and this is part of what is driving his calendar and his travel decisions. If you think about Paul's burden for the churches, in Galatians 4 verse 19, here's a church worried by false teachers. And he says, I am in labor pains for you. In labor pains, like a woman giving birth. That is Paul's earnest prayer and desire for the churches to be healthy. He writes in 2 Corinthians 11 verse 28, the daily pressure on me of my anxiety for all the churches. Can you see what's at the heart of this man's concerns? You see what is foremost in his mind, and now it is dictating to his calendar and his travel plans. He is gripped with the reality of these things. His heart is full of them, and it's spilling out into what decisions he makes every single day and his future plans. Now, what you will not realize is that Paul writes what we know as 1 Corinthians. And he sends off Timothy to sort of plug up the hole and do some temporary measures. But what you don't know is, not soon from now, Paul actually goes on an emergency visit to Corinth. The situation is so bad, Timothy probably goes there and he probably sends Paul a letter saying, it's bad, you better come. So Paul goes. And he goes and he pulls out the shepherd's staff and he gives it to them. He calls it his painful visit. And then he writes another letter. In fact, Paul wrote four letters to the Corinthians. 1 Corinthians is technically 2 Corinthians, because he talks about another letter that he had previously written in 1 Corinthians 5 verse 9. Then he did the painful visit and sent a painful letter. And then 2 Corinthians is technically 4 Corinthians. So there's actually four letters altogether. But all of that to say, here is a man who is bent on seeing the health of the local church. And it is dictating to how he lives his life. Paul reminds me a lot of John Wesley and his dedication to the work of the Lord. John Wesley was the founder of the Methodist Church and was a relentless minister for the Lord. After his conversion, he ministered faithfully for 53 years, and his daily regimen was brutal. This man went to bed at 10 o'clock every night and woke up at 4 o'clock every morning, and he was often preaching his first sermon by 5 a.m. He is credited with traveling 400,000 kilometers on horseback. That's going around the circumference of the earth 10 times. Sometimes he would wake up at 5 in the morning and get off his horse at 11 that night in order to travel all day on horseback to get to his next preaching post. He preached between 2 and 5 times a day and is credited with preaching 40,000 sermons. Now this morning I asked my wife to help me with a calculator. So if a normal minister is ministering at a church for 50 years and he preaches 2 sermons on a Sunday and 1 Wednesday night Bible study, so 3 times a week, that's 7,800 sermons. John Wesley preached 40,000 sermons. 5 times as much as an ordinary preacher, if not more. Wesley sought to give it all for God. He is credited with the words, do all the good you can to all the people you can, as long as you ever can. As long as ever you can. Here was a man bent on one thing, the will of God. Like Jonathan Edwards, as a young man, he wrote a number of resolutions. And they're very difficult to read, but it shows you his attitude. Here are 2 of them. Resolved, never to lose one moment of time, but to improve it in the most profitable way I possibly can. We read this morning from Psalm 90, teach us to number our days. There's that attitude coming through. Resolve to live with all my might while I do live. What's so impressive as we look at Paul's life, as we look at his travel plans, as we look at what motivates him as he makes every single decision that he makes, he's pouring himself out for God. Why such resolve? Why does Paul do this? Is he just one of those dramatic personalities who's just a bit of an extremist and he needs to settle down and, you know, if he had a wife, you know, she'd sort him out? No. He is a man who is fully given to God. And he is given to God because all he is doing is he is simply imitating God's own resolve and God's own dedication and God's own work in saving us. God is single-minded in the pursuit of saving us for his glory. From eternity past, he planned it, and every event of human history is working up to the grand event of Christ coming and dying. If we're amazed at men traveling great distances to bring the word of life to others, if we marvel at those who gladly give their lives, who commit every second, who make every effort in service to others, then our greatest adoration can only go to one. That is God himself in Jesus Christ, the one who left heaven's glories, the one who served without failure, who did not sin once, the one who paid the highest price, suffering the very wrath of God to save sinners. Paul pours himself out for others because this is what Christ has done for him. It's interesting if you go back to the book of Genesis. God works for 6 days and then rests. And then he makes man in his image. What's man to do? Well, man is to work like God. Man is to work and rest. And that's all Paul is doing. In the image of God, he is working as God has worked. He is pouring himself out for others. But Paul is also a servant who is submitted to the Lord's will. Look halfway through verse 7 to verse 9 with me. If the Lord permits, but I will stay in Ephesus until Pentecost, for a wide door for effective work is open to me, and there are many adversaries. Paul would be what we would describe as a typical type A personality, decisive, competent, driven, but ultimately he is a believer who is submitted to the Lord's will. We're familiar with the statement, if the Lord wills. Maybe you've seen it. Have you ever seen someone writing in a letter, at the end of the letter there's those two DV? Deo volente, God willing. DV. This is not just pious verbiage that Christians throw around as a type of virtue signaling in their speech. This is something that indicates a biblical worldview. This indicates the fact that we believe that there is a God and we live under him. We are not the forgers of our own fate. We are not God. We do not shape reality by the power of our wills and our determination. We are creatures. There is only one God who is over all things, and his plans are irresistible. As Christians, we are those who used to resist his will. We used to question how he ruled his universe and brought his will to pass. But now we have seen our sin. We have seen our folly. We have accepted our finitude. And we gladly rest in his good, wise hands. We recognize that he alone is right, that he alone is competent, whose every decision is perfection and worthy of praise. And so we gladly live under his will, not our own. This statement is a statement that reveals that we are under duty to do what is right, even though the results are ultimately left to the Lord. Proverbs 16 verse 9 says, "The heart of man plans his ways, but the Lord establishes his steps." So this means that we commit a lot of time and a lot of resources. And as we apply ourselves while recognizing that the fruits and the outcome are ultimately in the Lord's hands. So if God's plan is for us to experience loss, not plenty, to show forth our faithfulness in the midst of difficulty, the Lord knows best. We accept what He has appointed. We submit to the Lord's will. This statement reveals that God has given us commands that we are to obey, but He has not necessarily given us a full description of everything that we ought to do on a daily basis. There are general commands that we obey, like be holy, but we don't know. He has not pointed out every single little decision. There are things that Paul doesn't know. He knows the general will of God. I must be an apostle to the Gentiles. I should be seeking to break new ground and plant new churches where the gospel hasn't been heard. And so he pours himself out and he strives and he plans and he works hard in that direction. But the Lord may change direction. The Lord may change his plans. He doesn't know everything that God has planned, and that's okay. If the Lord wills. This is the world that Paul is happy to live in. Here on earth, we have a worm's eye view. And we do live by faith, where we can't see everything. We don't have that bird's eye view. We don't have God's perspective on everything. We may have to go through a door not knowing what lies on the other side. We may have to render a costly obedience, not guaranteed a blessing on the other side. But we are the Lord's and we gladly obey. Even though we don't have all the information that we would like. Like Paul, we are servants who submit to the will of the Lord in these things. This is ultimately as well a statement of humility that recognizes that God has the one who has the right to decide how our lives are lived. As James indicates in James 4, verse 13 and 15 and 16, where he writes, "Come now, you who say today or tomorrow we will go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and make a profit. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. As it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil." Now, we're not apathetic in our planning, but we are always mindful that we are ultimately subject to the will of the Lord. If you have this understanding, this is a statement which will render you malleable. Because if God decides to change the situation, you're okay with that. You're okay with whatever he gives you. You'll notice that Paul is not quite sure how long he's going to stay in Corinth, offering tentative arrangements. Maybe this, maybe that. Now, this is not because he is fickle. This is not because he is indecisive. But because he knows that God may open a different door and send him in a new direction. Here is a Corinthian church. It's already a church. They're in trouble, yes. Who needs Paul's ministry more than a church? Those who haven't even heard the gospel yet. So Paul recognizes that he may be called away to another mission field and not be able to go to Corinth. And he's open to that. He's willing for God to change his plans. And so we see Paul's own application of this in his attitude in staying in Ephesus. Even though there are opponents. Just think about the Ephesian ministry with me for a moment. It was here that Paul rebaptized the so-called disciples of John the Baptist, those who had not even heard of the Holy Spirit. It was here that the seven sons of Sceva attempted to cast out demons in the name of Jesus that Paul preached. But the town of Ephesus, think about it. This was a town, third largest in the Roman Empire, renowned for its riches. It had a famous temple to Artemis, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. And it was a center, a well-known center for occult training. So if you wanted to get into wizardry and all those arts, esoteric arts, Ephesus was the place that had a massive library committed to these things. But Paul wants to stay in Ephesus. Why? Because God had opened wide a door for effective ministry. The events with the seven sons of Sceva resulted in people paying attention and the gospel taking hold. Listen to Acts 19, 17 to 20. "And this became known to all the residents of Ephesus, both Jews and Greeks, and fear fell upon them all, and the name of the Lord Jesus was extolled. Also many of those who were now believers came, confessing and divulging their practices. And a number of those who had practiced magic arts brought their books together and burned them in the sight of all. And they counted the value of them and found it came to 50,000 pieces of silver. So the word of the Lord continued to increase and prevail mightily. There's that wide open door. That's, now you know why Paul is lingering in Ephesus. What we're seeing in Ephesus is revival. It's a real revival. That the whole DNA of that town, a town known for its commitment to the occult, that town is being turned on its head through the power of the gospel. And Paul's saying, there's too much to do here. I better stay. I better see this through. And he's taking advantage of that opportunity. Paul is so happy to often leave a newly planted church in the hands of some elders as he moves on to preach in a new place. But he feels that he must stay in Ephesus because of just this incredible opportunity that's going on around him. Paul was very effective as the word went forward. Acts 19 verse 10 puts it this way. Paul's teaching in the halls of Tyrannus, and it says, this continued for 2 years so that all the residents of Asia heard the word of the Lord, both Jews and Greeks. Phew! All the residents of Asia. That's a big statement. So you can see why Paul is lingering in Ephesus. But Paul, as someone who was submitted to the work of the Lord, stayed in Ephesus, not because it was great. There were also opponents. There were adversaries. There were problems. And it is likely that the enemies that he mentions in 1 Corinthians 16 were in fact the silversmiths that caused a riot later in Ephesus. You don't have to read far in Paul's missionary journeys to see that he was dogged by the Jews from town to town, how there was endless persecution in his life. Paul would eventually be imprisoned for preaching the word, but even this did not deter him. He was submitted to the will of the Lord, which means he would do the will of God even though it was difficult, even though it was opposed, even though he would experience persecution. And he went on. And even though there was persecution and even though there was difficulty, we know that the word of the Lord still prospered. One commentator compares this situation of Paul to the life of John G. Patton. While John Patton was a university student in Scotland, God called him to missionary work in the New Hebrides. After graduation, he and his bride sailed to the Southwest Pacific and began work among the savage cannibals on the island of Tanna. His wife and his infant son died a few months later. And Patton slept on their graves for several nights to prevent the cannibals from digging up their bodies in order to eat them. After almost 4 years of faithful work, he left the island without seeing one convert. Not one convert. Many years later, his son, by another marriage, resumed the work on Tanna and eventually saw the entire island come to Christ. When the elder Patton revisited the island, the chief of the former cannibals asked the missionary who the great army was that had surrounded his hut every night when he first came to them. These men were seeing the angels that were protecting his hut at night. Because of his faithful work and that of his son, when he left the New Hebrides for the very last time as an older man, after ministering on another island as well, it is reported that he said with tearful eyes, I don't know of one native on these islands who has not made a profession of faith in Jesus Christ. He continued to minister despite the difficulties. And the word of the Lord continued to prosper. This is part of what a servant of the Lord submits to. But Paul was a man who trusted in the will of God, yes, who submitted to the will of God, yes, who endured difficulty, yes, but we must also appreciate that though Paul believed in a sovereign God and he was happy to submit to his will, Paul was also a man of action, a man who used means. Paul was a big believer in prayer. So even though he says, if the Lord wills, this doesn't make him a fatalist. This doesn't make him passive in any way. Listen to Paul's exhortation to the Colossians in Colossians 4, verse 2 to 4. Continue steadfastly in prayer, being watchful in it with thanksgiving. At the same time, pray also for us that God may open a door to us, a door for the word, to declare the mystery of Christ, So he still asks for prayer. He still asks these young Christians to pray for him, that the door would be opened. He believes that prayer works. Yes, he will trust in the Lord to open doors. And yes, he's asking the Christians to pray for those doors to be opened. It's not either or, it's both and. And finally, we come to our last point as we consider the Lord's workers in verses 10 and 11. When Timothy comes, see that you put him at ease among you, for he is doing the work of the Lord as I am. So let no one despise him. Help him on his way in peace, that he may return to me, for I am expecting him with the brothers. Ministry, it is said, is not a solo sport, it is a team sport. Well, it's not a sport at all, but you know what I mean. Paul, though an extremely gifted individual, often teamed up with others in his work. Paul and Barnabas, Paul and Silas, Paul and Luke, Paul and John Mark, Paul and Timothy, Paul and Titus. You just have to look at the ends of his letters when he writes about those who are fellow workers with him, and go to Romans 16 and all the people that he lists as fellow workers in the work of the Lord. And so here we see that Paul is sending one of his fellow workers, Timothy, to Corinth. Paul is not yet able to come because of the wonderful revival going on in Ephesus. But there are serious matters developing, and so he needs to send someone. So he sends Timothy. If you look at 1 Corinthians 4, verse 17, you can see he's already mentioned this, and here's the purpose of why he's sending Timothy. That is why I sent you Timothy. Timothy was probably the one who carried the letter of Corinthians to the church. That is why I sent you Timothy, my beloved and faithful child in the Lord, to remind you of my ways in Christ as I teach them everywhere in every church. Now, who is Timothy? What's his role? I agree with John Owen that Timothy is an evangelist in the spirit of Ephesians 4, verse 11. You know where Paul says apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastors, teachers? So that's an order. Apostles at the top, then second to apostles, prophets, then third is evangelists. And below an evangelist is pastors and teachers. Timothy and Titus are apostolic representatives. So that's the way that the word evangelist is being used in that context, at that time. We use it in a different way. Maybe we would use it to describe a Billy Graham. That's not the way it's being used there. Okay, different sense. An evangelist was a sent one, an authorized representative of the apostles. And so Timothy, because Paul was either in prison or couldn't travel, Timothy would go and do what Paul would do in that situation, putting things in order over the church with an apostle's authority on his behalf. But here's the problem. The Corinthians have grown critical of Paul because, remember, slander has gone on in the Corinthian context. The tongue has set on fire the course of nature, and even though Paul was the one who planted this church, slander has gotten into their ears, and Paul's reputation has been poisoned before them. On top of that, the Corinthians themselves have been ministered to by Apollos. When Paul started his ministry at Ephesus, Apollos went to Corinth. So they've had the benefit of Apollos' ministry for a few years earlier. And we know that there were some possible divisions along the lines of people who liked Paul or people who liked Apollos. And now they're asking that Apollos would be sent to them, but instead of Paul, instead of Apollos, who gets sent? Oh, it's just little Timothy. That's the guy that's getting sent. Poor little Timothy. He's the one, you know, plan C. Timothy is the one who gets sent to the Corinthian church. Paul fears that he may not be well received. Paul fears that the animosity that's been raised against him will be taken out on Timothy. And so he asks that Timothy should be given respect because of what he is doing. He is doing the work of the Lord as Paul is doing. Why is Paul saying this? What's Paul doing? What's Paul revealing about his understanding of human nature? We are biased creatures. We are biased creatures who give preference to famous people, to good-looking people, to people that we associate with success, or people that we associate with power. Timothy might lack the finesse of Apollos, You might lack the intensity of Paul. You might lack the experience of Titus, but he is the Lord's man doing the Lord's work and ought to be received for that reason. Paul knows our weaknesses and he tells the Corinthians not to despise him, as well as help him on his way, just as they would Paul. We live in an age of celebrity preachers. You will find preachers much more gifted than your humble local church pastors. Men who've written books, who've got gigantic ministries, who've got many followers, who are known internationally. Sadly, there are many Christians who go online and not to church for their spiritual food. There are many who are more influenced by personalities online with their slick ministries and their platforms rather than sitting under the shepherd whom God has set over you. Have you ever thought about those words? The shepherds that God has set over you? Now, I know that some people might have some post-traumatic stress disorder on that, some PTSD. I'm not trying to trigger you on that front. I know there have been those who've abused their spiritual authority. But there is a legitimate authority where God has put pastors over you, like shepherd over a sheep. You know, where that shepherd gets the right to analyze under the fur and pull the wool back and see if there's a tick. You know? Are you submitting to the shepherds who are over you, who have to give an account to God, who are seeking to care for your souls? So Paul is trying to make some space for Timothy to have this sort of ministry amongst the Corinthians. Further to that, look at verse 12 as he mentions Apollos. Now concerning, and this is probably just a little code that you can crack in Corinthians. Every time you see the word now concerning in Corinthians, it means they probably wrote a letter asking about it. Okay? So they asked about Apollos. Now concerning our brother Apollos, I strongly urged him to visit you with the other brothers, but it was not at all his will to come now. He will come when he has opportunity. Who is Apollos? Well, we know that he was an Alexandrian Jew who had been converted, who was quickly used by the Lord because of the depth of his spiritual understanding. He was a very popular and able preacher. And we know that it is possible that he has a fan club in Corinth because of the time that he spent there. And there were divisions between, well, I think Apollos is the better preacher, and I think Paul's the better preacher. I like Apollos, I like Paul. And there was this tension going on in the Corinthian church. We see that in chapter 1. And here we see the Corinthians writing to Paul to ask Apollos to come. Because maybe they know they're in trouble. Maybe they know they've got problems. And they want someone that they have confidence in to come and help them untie the knots that they're in. So they've asked for Apollos. Paul indicates that he's heard this message, he's passed on this message, and now he's letting them know that Apollos has chosen not to come. And it seems the details here might be indicating that in order to avoid understanding, he's showing that this is Apollos' choice. Paul's not ordering Apollos around. Paul hasn't ordered Apollos not to come. This is not Paul trying to over-control the situation. He's indicating that Apollos has chosen not to come. And he hasn't really explained a lot of why. Why has Apollos chosen not to come? Paul doesn't feel the need to explain that. Okay, he just simply relays the information. Maybe Apollos knows that there is favoritism going on. Maybe he's unhappy. Maybe he's also taking advantage of the Ephesian situation. We just don't know. But what we see here is just an openness and a transparency in communication between Paul and this church at this point. Well, friends, let's conclude. Paul is a man on a mission. Everything in his life is channeled into this primary purpose of his life. He is not living life like a tourist, but as one under orders. He is fully given to the work that the Lord has called him to. Whether it's difficult, whether it involves going to far places, whether it involves persecution, the loss of health, all of his actions and all of his decisions can be explained by this controlling desire to be about the Lord's business. Like John Wesley, like George Whitefield, like David Livingstone, he was all about one thing. But he was also submitted to the Lord's will. He was not his own. He was submitted to another. This included not knowing what tomorrow held. This included accepting good with the bad. This did not lead to fatalism, but a faithful employment of the means like preaching and prayer. And Paul was a co-laborer with others in God's work. He respected these others, put them forward, defended and spoke up for them, because they too were given to a noble task. Well, here's a concluding challenge for all of us. As you look at your life, as you look at your plans, as you look at your traveling, are you a man or a woman on a mission? Let's pray.